Welcome to the Human Capital Lab podcast, where learning transforms work and lives. Hosted by Executive Director Rich Douglas, we explore how education and innovation create opportunities to drive impact in the field of talent development. Get ready. Today's episode starts now.
Hey, folks. Welcome to another edition of the Human Capital Lab podcast. And we are here a few times a month to bring you interesting topics and guests regarding human capital management and the talent development field that's loosely defined. We're all over the place. So we've had a wide array of guests. Today we have Jennifer Sutherland, and Jennifer and I met at a conference a while back and we just got talking and we really enjoyed our conversation together and we thought we'd bring it to the podcast and have you enjoy it. I'm Dr. Rich Douglas. I'm your host and the executive director of the Human Capital Lab. Check us out at humancapitallab.org. We're a not-for-profit, non-commercial community, a virtual community of human capital management and talent development practitioners. And we're here just to help elevate each other's game and to help ourselves move along both in terms of our own careers and also in the clients that we serve. So today we have Jennifer Sutherland, and Jennifer is the newly minted Global Head of Learning Operations for ZS, and she'll be talking a little bit about that when she shares with you her background. And she has a wide, varied background in talent development, including running her own practice, Sutherland Talent Solutions. And so, as a lot of us are, we're in the business of running consulting practices, so I thought that would be an interesting topic as well. And before we get any further, let me introduce Jennifer and ask Jennifer to introduce herself.
Awesome. Thank you. Hi. Yeah, I was lucky enough. As soon as I went to the conference, the very first person I sat down next to was Rich. So it was great. We had a conversation and we realized we were both speaking on similar topics at that conference and that they really aligned and dovetailed. So I'm excited to talk about that a little bit. Some topics that I think both of us are very passionate about. So my name is Jennifer. I've been in learning and development for 20 plus years, and I was in sales prior to that. So I did sort of this weird career transition to training from sales, and I have been in training long enough that the term sales enablement didn't exist back then. LMSs were basically paper. So it's been a long journey. I've worked for very small companies. I've worked for large companies. I have led large learning teams. At one point, I had 180 people that reported up through me because we were supporting call center training. It was very active, high volume training and high volume hiring. I've also worked for a company where there was two of us. And so I was very much a everyday practitioner as well as strategy and thought leader. So I've kind of done both. I've been at CS now for just a few months, but a couple times a year, people reach out to me for different projects and that's my side gig, which I call my retirement plan.
Now, hang on, because you just triggered me. Why do you call it your retirement plan? What are you looking at?
Yeah, so, you know, I am risk averse when it comes to my salary and benefits. I know other people are able to do it, and I think that's phenomenal. I have just been very risk averse to sort of step away from a corporate role. But when I'm ready to retire, I know I'm not going to retire. I'm going to still want to do some stuff. And so I already have sort of an established, you know, strategy and a little bit of a client base, but also source materials and collateral and a website. So it gives me a nice runway. So when I'm ready to retire, I've already got some things established, as well as understanding what my processes might look like and what I want to focus on. And a sort of parallel journey, I also am an adjunct professor. So that's my second component of my retirement plan, is to continue doing the adjunct professor thing. And because I can do that virtually from anywhere. So it allows me to have that flexibility to travel and do all of that. So I'm young enough to not retire immediately, but not young enough to not think about these things. And I want to sort of have that strategy moving forward. So I know that was something we were just talking about a little bit off camera that I thought was kind of interesting about your work.
You know, and thank you for noting that. Traditionally, retirement was funded with a three-legged stool. The three legs were pensions, savings, and Social Security. As we know, the pension scene changed around 1980, the advent of the 401k, and almost immediate switch from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans. And the other thing is that with lifestyles and with life spans and health spans getting longer, the concept of retirement now has a fourth leg, and that is work. What does it mean to be working in retirement. And one of the things that folks out there might want to consider is starting that side gig or doing something that you really love, because there may come a time when you want to switch from giving your all to giving your best and invoicing accordingly. So in making that transition, it shouldn't be an all or nothing thing. Adam Grant reminds us in the book Originals about safe to fail experiments and not to necessarily bet the entire house on one venture, idea, or activity, or chance, et cetera, but rather to be able to try things out. And one of the things you can do in consulting is you can try yourself out and see whether or not you're enjoying that kind of work and you're enjoying the clients and the business development aspects of it and all the other things that are in the, and the administration. I mean, the first thing you had to do is figure out, hey, how do I get paid? I mean, that I wish more consultants would pay attention to early on. So the opportunity to do these kinds of things, and you just mentioned two of them, really provide an opportunity to take on all kinds of things that you can't yet anticipate. In other words, our favorite acronym, which is VUCA. And this is one of the first things that we want to talk about today. And for the one person out there who hasn't heard of VUCA, VUCA is an acronym, and it really captures the essence of the chaos, the weirdness of things into the future. And VUCA stands for volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And the more we advance in our careers, the more VUCA we face, because that's what we're paid to do. You know, early on in your career, you get a job description, you get handed a set of tasks, and your job is to do that stuff. Not a lot of VUCA. But later on, especially when you're in leadership positions, I mean real leadership positions where you're actually making decisions about the direction of the organization, VUCA becomes what you're paid to deal with. You're paid to deal with the unknown threats and challenges and opportunities that are out there. You presented about VUCA, and I know you wanted to come in and talk about VUCA. Now that we've set the stage, what's on your mind about it?
So I think one of the things when I think about VUCA, a lot of people think about the business aspect of it, which is obviously critical. The business has to be prepared. The business makes decisions. But I think our role as learning and development, talent development, org development, human capital is so critical to setting up an organization for success related to VUCA, because VUCA is inevitable. It is just, it's happening all the time for a variety of different things. Gen AI is a great example. We'll probably talk about that. But when I think about our role in learning and how we need to prepare the organization to be resilient, to be flexible, to be able and comfortable to make decisions without having all the answers, I just get really passionate about this idea that we can be a huge part of this conversation to prepare organizations, to prepare the employees, to prepare everybody from, you know, the highest level of leader down to somebody who is doing their job every day and sort of taking on those tasks, as you mentioned. But when something happens and they don't maybe have all the answers, there is, you know, complex sort of decision-making paths. How do we prepare people beforehand to be ready for that so that they already have those muscles that they can make those decisions and start to feel comfortable with some ambiguity and moving forward? So to me, it's just really tied really nice to learning and development and what we can do related to the business to make sure they're successful.
So let's start answering your question. You posed it as a rhetorical question, and I'm going to turn it into a real one. How do we prepare people to be prepared to take on the unknown?
I think the best way is to start immediately, right? Like, you probably can't fix where somebody's at now, but we can start to prepare them from now for the future. And the best possible ways is to start building that critical thinking skills so that they can start to anticipate how they would make decisions. So scenario-based type of activities, getting people together in group activities so there's sort of sharing of knowledge and ideas so that people aren't doing things in a vacuum, creating some of these trainings that start to build a skill set. So most people, when we talk about VUCA, talk about the biggest thing related to VUCA is sort of this, you know, reaction and being flexible and resilient. Resilience is the word that comes up all the time. So how do you build resilience? Well, it's really about that critical thinking, the being able to be flexible, to recognize that there might be a potential bad decision made because you don't have all the answers right away, but you still need to move forward.
It's almost like a game of chess where you have an idea of what you want to do in any situation, but you have no idea what your opponent's going to do. And the conditions in which you're working in business is that opponent and the possibility of things rising up that you didn't anticipate, or, you know, you thought we'd go left, but we went right instead, really calls upon the individual's ability, their capacity. And this is a distinction that I like to make in leadership development, which is we talk in leadership development all the time about competencies. And everybody's got a competency model, and most of them are really good. I mean, why not? You know, we basically know what it takes to be a leader in terms of what you're able to do and the characteristics that you're able to build up, and, you know, that whole trait versus behavior theory, but they really are both. So we kind of know what that formula looks like, but there's another element to it. I'd like to get your thoughts on this, which is building capacity. You know, where somebody is, I have no more effective way of saying this than becomes a bigger person than they were before. So it's fine to have all kinds of abilities, but like Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan till you get punched in the mouth. And that's kind of VUCA in a nutshell. So how do we build this capacity in people to be able to take on more and more of the unknown? What are some of the things that you would do?
Yeah, I love that. It's interesting that you talked about like chess. I always think like VUCA is a very sort of like modern day approach to, like, we used to do SWOT analysis all the time in business college, right? So thinking about the strengths and weaknesses, the opportunities, the threats, the internal, the external. VUCA is basically taking those same sort of considerations, but preparing somebody to handle those things. So not just what might happen, but now that things have happened, how do we prepare people? So to me, one of the biggest things is, you know, simulations and scenarios, having conversations, understanding that every single situation is going to have multiple potential decision-making components, decision tree. And every time you make a decision, there's going to be another set of decisions. And somewhere along that journey, the VUCA is going to kick in. It's going to be volatile, meaning things are changing super, super quickly. It's going to be uncertain, meaning we have no idea what's coming next. Like we can't see around the bend to know what's next. It might be complex because there's like 12,000 factors to consider, or it just might be that ambiguous, just kind of like, it might be this, it might be that. We don't know what direction we're going in. So having scenario-based situations that are similar now that you can sort of anticipate and start to build that skill set is huge. Because it's that conversation and starting to think, okay, if I make this decision, what's that outcome going to look like? And I'm not thinking like necessarily like traditional e-learning where, oh, let me press this and then they tell me that happened or that happened. But it's more of a group conversation. This is, to me, VUCA skills should not be isolated. They should be built across multiple functions, across multiple levels within an organization, so that decision-making skill set can be built. So I keep talking about decision-making. There is another component to VUCA, training sort of arm related to VUCA, you know, building that, the self-knowledge, the self-identity, but also understanding how other people are reacting to it, you know, how to share bad news, you know, as a leader, how to have that. And I know one of the things that you focused on at the conference that we went to was the role within coaching of VUCA, which I think is really cool. I kind of talked about L&D specifically, you talked about coaching specifically, and those two things very much merge. You know, from a coaching perspective, it's getting feedback and thinking about how you would reflect on something to do it differently next time and anticipate in this exact same scenario today, what would you do differently? And reflecting on what did you do and how and why and sort of going through that thought process, the reflection is a huge part of being prepared for VUCA. I think about when I was my second job out of college, I think it was, I worked for what would be called like an educational publisher. We literally published hardback books that I would go and sell to school districts, and they were hardbacks. And then around a year and a half into that job, we started doing more publishing and software type of stuff. And I remember people in the business going, oh, well, this is not going to work because people are never going to want books again. They're going to only want electronic books. Absolutely not. I have hardback books sitting next to my desk. I read them all the time. You know what I mean? You think about that VUCA situation of, okay, here's something that's happening. How do we anticipate it? But that emotional intelligence of building your resilience to that change is just as important what decisions you're making. Like, how do you allow your body to react and think through it before you jump and act and move forward? So there's a little bit of that as well when we're thinking about very specific skills related to VUCA. Because otherwise it sounds very loosey, you know, it's like, I don't really know. Like, how do you prepare for that? But there are skills that we absolutely can align to things around VUCA and the decision-making and the outcomes that you need to make.
So it sounds to me like these skills can be developed and transferred to situations that we don't know are coming yet. So that's the idea about capacity. You talked about capacity without using the word, and I'm going to use the word because it's really about being able to withstand the change, be able to take the hit, if you will, and still be standing and still be able to deal with it. You know, I love a quote by a general later on, President Eisenhower, and he talked about D-Day, which is the largest amphibious assault in the history of mankind. It remains so. It was amazing. And what he said was, you know, we planned, trained, communicated, we conducted intelligence, we equipped, we recruited, you know, a couple million people. And we did that over 2 years. He said, that got us on the beach.
Right. But
then we had to improve. And in some ways, all of this training is designed to get you on the beach so that you could then improvise or adjust or react or whatever. But if you're no longer standing, you can't do any of that. And so I think it's really important that we put people in real world situations where they do go through stress and they do go through the emotional change and they do have that significant emotional event, as some psychologists will call it, to where you feel like, all right, I survived that unknown. I can take on the next unknown. And then once you're able to stand there and withstand the winds of VUCA, be able to then turn around and say, well, all right, what do I do now?
So true.
You know, how am I going to navigate through this? So it's really about building up the person, not just their technical abilities.
Absolutely. Yeah, that it's the soft skills, people skills, universal skills, whatever we want to call them. Funny example. So I worked for a healthcare insurance company, and it was right at the beginning of healthcare reform. And my job was literally to learn about the new law and understand how it was going to impact our business, but then translate that to the salespeople. So what did salespeople need to know about healthcare reform? And it was a huge change for the industry. We call it healthcare reform. In my opinion, it was a healthcare insurance reform, more so than even healthcare reform, at least initially. So things about, you know, there's 10 essential benefits and preventive medical was now covered. And it was just a huge change for the industry. And to your point of preparing for something and then having it, you know, having to react in the moment, we had spent months preparing for this training. It was a 4-hour in-person training that I was delivering. And it was to salespeople from the organization as well as external insurance agents. And I remember during one of the breaks, because it was 4 hours, and so we took a lot of breaks. During one of the breaks, I just kind of stepped out and I went by the coffee shop in our office. And during that break, there was a press release or a press conference with President Obama, completely changing something that we had implemented based on healthcare reform. And I remember walking back into the training conference room and just going, so remember what I just told you? Guess what? That no longer is going to exist. We don't know what that's going to look like just yet, but hot off the press type of thing, it's going to change. And I just remember in that moment going, okay, I can handle this. Like, this is meant to be sort of messy, right? We're all going through this together and we are trying to be ahead of the game and trying to train people before everything was known. Very VUCA situation. But with that, we had to go, you know what? We're going to get some of these things. Some of these things are just going to come up and pop up and whatever. And I just recognized in myself, I was like, yeah, I can handle this. Like that was a big deal. It was like 250 people in that conference room that I had to be like, so this is a funny story. I don't know if anybody else had just heard this, but I remember that was like one of my biggest VUCA moments as a trainer in L&D that I could like translate for the rest of my career, that I'm just going to always remember that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And the idea is that managers handle the known. You know, they handle the things, if it's broken, fix it. If it's late, speed it up. If it's costing too much, save some money. Managers keep things on track. It's leaders mm-hmm. who really live in VUCA. That's where leadership lies, especially strategic leadership. You know, we have tactical leadership, which is, you know, how we engage people and motivate them and evaluate performance and all the other things we do in our jobs. But those are really management yeah. skills. But to truly lead an organization or to be part of the leadership of an organization, taking it from the present to the future, that's where leadership lies. And so if, I guess to the audience, what I would say is that if you're comfortable with the idea of being in the unknown, of being exposed, of being relied upon to come up with, you know, the direction of the organization when you don't know, then really are oriented toward being a strategic leader. And if you're not, if you like running things and you like keeping things on track and you like fixing things and things from simple to the complicated, but you're applying known solutions and you're solving problems, which is, you know, 80-90% of what a manager does anyway, then great. Gravitate towards those things. It's the folks who find themselves in the chaos of VUCA, remember, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, and then are unhappy.
Right.
That perhaps have made the wrong decision about the direction of where they're going. Also, there are organizations that don't prepare people. They simply don't. We say, oh, you're a new manager. We'll give you supervisory training. And that's fine. That's what people need. But I think that the real proof of the pudding actually lies a little bit later when we take managers and turn them into strategic leaders. And if we don't do that, if we don't give them that experience, not just skill set, you know, this is, it's fine to give them the knowledge, you know, and to send them through whatever training to increase their awareness, but to give them the real world experiences. And you mentioned something else, and that is, and I'm going to call it a different title, but it's the same thing. And that's the clash of ideas when people are actually coming together going, boom, we don't know what to do. What are we going to do here? Those clashes of ideas all build this capacity in people and help prepare them for those challenges and opportunities that they haven't yet seen.
Yeah. I think about like some of the leaders, you know, specific examples of people I would consider great leaders that I've worked for and the way they handle VUCA situations, the unknown, when there are things that are coming down the line. You think about the leaders that how they handle COVID or if there's potential competitor hitting the market or whatever. Those leaders that show a little bit of that vulnerability, but they're still saying, I don't know the answer, but here's where I think our direction should be based on what we're researching, based on what we've seen in the past. That to me, 100% is a leader I will follow all day long. The people that kind of go out there and go, everything's fine, everything's great, everything's fine, everything's great. And everybody looks around and goes, we know it's not. Why aren't you willing to sort of announce that and feel comfortable with that? Because they think,
or somebody has made a decision and it's wrong and they won't move off of it. I found in my career as a leader, very often it was the second decision that was right.
Right? Exactly. What do they say? Fail fast, right?
It's not a good thing to do. Oh, okay. What do you think we ought to do? That is, to me, the sign of somebody who's willing to take on the complexity of the unknown. Somebody who can say, well, okay, we tried that. That didn't work. Let's try something different. Well, another thing you brought up and you hinted to was, you know, how do you react to these things in the moment? What do you like during the storm? The best supervisor I ever had was a guy nicknamed Behind His Back. One speed ball. Okay? Because nothing we had, this was my military career, we had at the time 82 jet fighter aircraft that we were responsible for maintaining and launching and retrieving and repairing. Okay. This was our responsibility. And he was the commander of that unit. I was his executive officer. So I was this trained monkey. And I'm telling you, nothing fazed Bob. Colonel Tolman out there, hope you get a chance to see this. You're an awesome dude. I'm telling you, he was just, nothing fazed him. It did underneath. He was that prototypical duck, right? Chrissy Palm, but underneath. Yeah, he got stuff done. But oh my goodness, his initial reaction to everything was, well, what do you think we should have to do about this? I would go, as you said, to the ends of the earth with a guy like, with a leader like that. And so, yeah, his one speed was simply, he just took everything with a calming nature, no matter how VUCA.
When I transitioned from sales to training, I worked for an employee assistance program. And so what we did was the clinical side, but I was hired to do the training. So clients that contracted with us as an EAP got free training from me, basically. And it was my first time really doing like soft skills training. And I remember one of my favorite topics to train was a concept called E plus R equals O. The event plus my reaction equals the outcome. And we would talk about the R. The event is a given. You cannot change an event, right? Whether it's traffic, whether it's, you know, weather, you know, somebody else's reaction, you can't own that. But your reaction is what you can own. That's what's going to have the impact on the outcome that you have control over. And so, like you said, like, if I understand I can't control whatever's happening here with a supplier, with, you know, some decision that came down the line that I might not have been a part of, but I have to implement or what have you, I can't change that event. What I can change is my reaction to it and how I'm going to. And so to me, that's always been sort of an underlying factor for me. Once I heard that strategy and trained it to other people, I was like, okay, that makes sense. Like, that is so critical.
And there's a parable about this called the two arrows. And the first arrow that hits you, you can't control. And that's what you were talking about. And the first arrow is, it hurts, you know, sometimes a sudden change, you know, when you walk back in and said, hey, everybody, we're going to toss that whole thing that we just talked about. That was the first arrow. The second arrow is the suffering. It's what we choose to do in reaction to the first arrow. And you're absolutely right. We can choose. It's not easy, but even the awareness that we have control, that we have agency, we can actually say, hey, you know what? I can do something about this. You know, it's not just what happened to me and I have to suffer with it, but rather I can actually react differently than I would if I let my, you know, let my emotions flow. I could actually say, no, I'm going to do something different. This comes from practice. And this means getting people, and this is what frustrates me about leadership development so much. We put people in the classroom and we teach them things and then we send them on their merry way as if it's all going to go with them. And you have been in enough training. You know what happens on a Friday afternoon. You know, you fill out that reaction form that's between you and your car. And man, you're gone. You take your little white binder and you put it on the shelf and you never look at it again. And this is true whether you're going to, you know, to company ABC supervisory training or whether you're going to the JFK School at Harvard and going through an executive leadership program there. What's missing is the experiential component. And being able to put that in there so that people can, maybe in under safe circumstances, think of learning how to ride a bike, maybe we'll put the training wheels on, but give them an opportunity to actually, you know, no one ever learned how to ride a bike by being told how to ride it. You know, eventually you got to get on with it.
Exactly.
What I'd like to do is I'd like to shift gears a little bit and give us an opportunity to head in a slightly different direction and talk about a particular aspect of VUCA that everybody's talking about today.
So yeah, as we think about leadership development and that sort of second arrow that you were talking about, the skill set people need is how to handle that first arrow so that the second arrow either doesn't get you or it doesn't hit like somewhere really critical. And that skill set is around practicing and being able to build the skills so that the next time you learn a little bit more each time. But you get that practical sort of application of it and understand where that is, because the whole point about VUCA is you can't anticipate the exact situation, but you can build the skills so that depending on the situation, you can react certain ways to minimize the pain or to maximize the benefit and the company's experience or the outcome of some sort. So thinking about that, I know that's a huge part of what we think about when it comes to VUCA and like the next stage of people learning and applying that information.
Well, speaking of learning and applying information, I think one of the biggest and the hottest topics going on is artificial intelligence, AI. Mm-hmm. And for those of you out there who maybe aren't as versed in AI as others, a simple way to look at it is there are two basic forms, two basic ideas behind AI. One of them is where the artificial intelligence mimics a machine or a human would do in a situation where, for example, 50, 100 years ago, if you got on an elevator, you had an elevator operator, you know, somebody who asked you what floor you wanted to go to and then operated the elevator and took you to that floor. And that's where you went and you got out. Now that's all done by a little computer. You step up, you press a button. It tells the elevator where you want to go. The elevator takes you there. That's an example of artificial intelligence. And we've had artificial intelligence for about as long as we've had intelligence. However, the latest wave is something a little bit different. Instead of replicating what a person might do, we have generative AI, where ostensibly, and I don't agree with everything that people are saying about it, but ostensibly, generative AI can, if prompted properly, create new things. And that is scaring a lot of people in a lot of ways. And I just wanted to get from your perspective, because you're very active in the talent development field and are well-versed in the technology side of things. I just wanted to get your reaction to what's going on with generative AI, the challenges that people are facing with it. What, tell us what's on your mind.
Yeah. So it's, I would say first thing is I was on a panel at a conference in the fall, and it was one of my favorite panels I've ever been on because it was about AI and learning. And although I had a lot of my own sort of examples and experience and situations, learning from other people's that I hadn't even thought about and their experiences related to it was like mind-blowing, sort of opened my eyes to a whole bunch of stuff. So the more conversations we have about Gen AI as learning leaders, as HR leaders, the more we'll all benefit from it. And I probably every day I get one or two emails about a webinar or an article or, you know, something about Gen AI and specifically around L&D and HR. And I wish I could attend them all, but they're all so valuable because they are opening up these opportunities. So to me, part of it now is a little bit like there's so many AI options. It's overwhelming to people and they're not sure where to start. So when I think about AI, I normally suggest to people kind of start small, like do something sort of basic, like use whichever format you want to use, whichever tool or app or whatever your work prefers, and to do something like rewriting an email. I love using it for that. It was one of my first entries into using AI was just, I was doing like, you know, my thoughts in an email and then I would ask it to rewrite it. And then I would say, oh, can you make this a little bit more succinct? Can you put this in bullet format? Can you know send this as if you know this is an executive summary? That not only helped my emails and like the AI actual component of it, but it helped me think differently because I would see how it would rewrite my emails and go, oh my gosh, yeah, that's so much easier. That makes so much more sense. That's so much clearer what the outcome is, the call to action at the end, that type of thing. But when I think about Gen AI and taking it, you know, multiple levels beyond that, I normally just suggest people start small and do something like that. But that idea of maximizing our efficiencies, coming up with new ways of doing things. Internally, our company has some really cool AI chatbots that we have developed that encourages employees to do things differently. But I've seen chatbots that will help answer questions from like a knowledge library. Instead of having to search for everything, hey, let's just ask a question like, how do I submit for reimbursement for that training that I did? Oh my gosh, here you go. Here's your five steps instead of you trying to find it. That right there is an efficiency. But when we think about, hey, let me give you access to all of these kind of things, what's the first thing I should do to approach this, to do this launch program for this type of training? Or help me clarify my thinking. Here's what I see as some of the, you know, the gaps in this. AI, you help me think of this from this lens. And I love that about AI, that you could tell it to think through different lenses. Like you are, you know, a data analyst, act like you are a CEO, act like you are an HR leader. Put those hats on and tell me, where do you find the gaps? Where do you see areas of opportunities? But where am I not addressing something that seems pretty critical? To me, that's really kind of taking things in a different direction. Every learning system that we have, whether it's a content provider, LMS, LXP, all has some sort of AI component to it. So I could go, hey, I want to find a training on such and such. What would you recommend? And then help me come up with a path, and then help me write an objective, and help me come up with a summary, and help me write some knowledge checks, and help me write the email to launch this. Help me decide how to analyze the data from the report. What are some of the key elements and analysis that you could see? To me, that's like a really cool like end-to-end functionality you can get that's already embedded, that's already there, makes it so easy for you. What I'm excited to see is what else, right? What else is coming down the line? And, you know, not to harken back to our previous topic, but AI is so much a great example of VUCA, because 3 years ago, I didn't do anything with AI in my job in that way. I never went to a website and said, okay, help me do this and this. That just wasn't a part of my job. That was not a thing that I did. It wasn't widespread. Now, 2 years ago, things started changing. So what's going to happen a year from now, 2 years from now? I don't know, but I'm super excited about it. Training people to think differently to use it is where it's going to come in handy, right? Helping people to see the opportunities to start preparing people to be ready for it. That's the thing we can do today. That's what we can start preparing for from a VUCA perspective, is preparing people to do it and be ready for the next level.
I think one of the key preparations is to remind people that AI, even as sophisticated as it become, is a tool for human beings. It tells lies. It gets fooled. It doesn't understand certain things. And if you are not grounded in what you're doing, you won't recognize where it makes those mistakes. On the other hand, from a positive perspective, to me, generative AI performs two functions that are really cool. One, it helps you get started. It just helps you start thinking about something, because it's, you know, it can take almost the universe of known information, at least publicly known, and be able to draw it in and say, is this what you're talking about? Is this what you're interested in? The other thing it's really good for is covering your bases. Did I hit everything? Was there anything I missed? What it is not good at, again, is judging. It's like, what's more important than the other? What would be a compassionate thing or a terrible, rude thing to do or say? It's terrible at that. And it's not going to be good at that. We are a long way from AI truly being comparable to HI, human intelligence. So I would encourage people not to be afraid of it and to do exactly what you said. Wander into it. Play with it a little. And I'll give you an example. Did a couple of doctoral degrees. And so one of them was a thesis on the chief learning officer. I wrote a very scholarly theory about the dynamic of the chief learning officer that, you know, nobody outside my committee and I have read, but that's okay. And I just asked a certain AI bot, in this case, ChatGPT, and I said, hey, I'm so-and-so, and I wrote a thesis at the University of Leicester. Can we turn that into a book? That's all I did. It found a public source of my thesis, analyzed it, and of course it came back positively because it's programmed that way. And it said, sure, would you like to see a sample table of contents? I didn't use it because it's not where I'm going with it. I just was sure about it.
Yeah.
So then I fed it my own self-published book on purposeful leadership development, which is all about the things we've been talking about today. And I said, how could I apply the principles in my book to what I found in my thesis? And again, hey, I got a sample model for you. Would you like to look at it?
Awesome.
Amazing. It's a wonderful tool. Did it replace my thinking? No. Because folks, remember, AI needs two things. It needs a database, because it just takes information. Okay, so it needs a database, something, whether it's discrete, where it says, you know, say company employee records would be a discrete database, or something as wide as the World Wide Web. And, or more importantly, the internet, bigger than the World Wide Web. And then it needs something else besides the database. It needs prompts. That's where we also come in. We have to be able to prompt it in ways that we get meaningful information. You know, when computers first became a thing, a common acronym tossed about was GIGO, G-I-G-O. And it's for garbage in, garbage out. And we have to remember that. that we can't just say, here, replace my brain, because we'll get garbage and we won't get anything useful. But that doesn't mean that we need to be afraid of it. There's wonderful opportunities. And I'll tell you right now, folks, I went to ChatGPT. They now have subscription levels where you can access even more sophisticated algorithms that do analysis. And for $20 a month, I'm getting these amazing results by asking questions about historical things and things I want to know more about. And I wanted to know about an obscure diploma mill operating in Missouri, and it found it and gave me all kinds of information from the 70s. Okay. And so it's amazing what you can do, because instead of saying, traditional searches, I know what I want and I know where to go look. With AI, you could say, I know what I want, help me go look.
Exactly. And cite your sources, to your point of accuracy, right? Cite your sources. And I think the prompt engineering that you mentioned is so critical, and it's such a fun thing to play with. You know, you could say, write this in a whimsical way, write this in a silly way, right? And you give it the different prompts to do the same thing. And that's when you start to see potential and start to go, okay, like, where can I figure this out? So I mentioned that I'm an adjunct professor. I remember about a year, maybe 2 years ago, in one of our faculty meetings, there was a lot of conversation about, oh no, all the students are going to cheat by using AI to write their papers. And yes, there is some validity to that. But one of the things I just read recently is that one of the biggest, most common ways students are using AI is to help clarify assignments, to help what you just said, sort of verify what I wrote. How does that match the rubric? Where are the gaps in my thinking? So they're not trying to say, hey, write me a paper that matches this rubric. It's saying, here, I've done this work. Help me figure out where I'm missing out. Help me. And I love that so much. So I am like going to be embedding that in my instructions. Like, I encourage you to use AI, but cite it. Tell me where you're using it. What were the prompts you were using to help you do that? Because I want to understand what their thinking is. So I think you're right on target there. And I think it's kind of cool and exciting to think about that. But knowing it's not human, there's that element in there we still have to kind of be aware of, that there's no emotion attached to it. And we have to verify that thinking. We have to verify the knowledge.
I think verify is the key. You know, when we teach a college class, for example, I have to decide three things. What are students to learn? And how will they learn it? And how will they demonstrate the learning? It's that third one that maybe we need to make some changes. You know, I mean, the internet was a tremendous change in what we did. When I was an undergraduate a long, long time ago, sitting there writing out essays in longhand, because that's what you had to
do. The blue book.
Yeah.
The blue book.
And you write them out.
Yeah.
You know, it's painful to think about that now. I try to sign my name and I almost can't do it because I'm just so...
You know, you're like, oh, there's so much writing.
I don't put anything down. I mean, you know, and even in conferences, I, you know, away quietly on a silent keyboard because, you know, who writes anymore? The point is that we need to go ahead and make those adjustments. We need to do it in the workplace too and be able to evaluate. And this is the key, not necessarily the inputs and the processes, but the outcomes, and be able to validate that it represents your work, or in the case of school, your learning. If we continue to do that, then we don't have to be afraid of the tools. We're so busy running around trying to figure out how we can detect cheating, instead of saying, how can we better assess this person's learning in ways that reach, you know, with Bloom's taxonomy, that reach higher levels, instead of just regurgitating facts, which is what a multiple choice test might do. How do we get to where we can have the student, maybe in real time or in some way that we can validate, show their ability to analyze and synthesize and be able to formulate new knowledge, you know, and
real world application of what they're learning.
Absolutely. And this stuff becomes another tool for them to get there, but the demonstration is the key.
Agreed.
Jennifer, I just wanted to kind of turn the tables. You know, this podcast is supposed to be guest centric, and I just want to see if there's anything else you want to share with the audience that we haven't talked about, but you want to make sure they know.
I would just say that, yes, the world is changing, but the role of a learning team needs to continue evolving as well. It's We need to be strategic. We need to be aligned to the business. We need to understand how important metrics and data is. But mostly, we just need to be really tied to the business from that strategy perspective. So really understanding who to partner with, what they're trying to solve for, being as proactive as possible is so critical. We cannot be order takers. We just can't. Otherwise, we are dismissed. So the best way to be a part of that conversation is to understand, what does the company do? How do we make money? What do our customers need from us? And what is the business trying to solve for? So the more we can do that as L&D, our industry will continue to evolve. And those conversations we had today, take those to the next level, take that back, have more conversations, reach out to Rich or I and have more of these conversations with us offline, like you evolving all of us at the same time.
That's too good. I have a riddle for you. What do you call a person who spends an entire career in the Air Force and never gets into an Air Force plane?
What do you call that person?
An airman. Because nice. We're all airmen. It doesn't matter. And if you joined a new company in March, and I understand you're, as you shared with me before we got started, you're going off to India to go with some of these folks. That is joining that organization a way that you really can't even do remotely, just going and being part of it and understanding it. If you work for a construction company, you don't necessarily have to know how to hang drywall, but you got to kind of know what the business is. What is the company in business of accomplishing? And I think your advice is so good for anybody out there in the talent development field. Make sure you get out of your bubble. Make sure that you get familiar with and understand the business challenges, because as talent developers, even when we're working inside a company, we're still consultants. We're still engaging our clients, in this case, our internal clients, finding out what they need, and then helping them come up with solutions to meet those business requirements. The more we understand the business, the more likely we'll be participants in VUCA.
Absolutely. Nice.
Anything else before we go?
Nope. Thank you so much for having me on. This is a great conversation.
You're such an ace. It was so much fun. I'm so glad we got a chance to talk again. So I look forward to it. Don't be a stranger. Let's stay in touch. I'd love to hear a trip when you get back. And also, you know, when it's time to scratch that itch, I hope you'll come back on for another episode.
For sure. Absolutely. Thank you so much. This was fantastic.
Terrific. Folks, this has been the Human Capital Lab podcast. You can check us out at humancapitallab.org, where we do so much more than a podcast. It is a community of practitioners, virtual community. Feel free to go to the website. Everything on the website's free. So we encourage you to go look and download and participate in anything that you're interested in, whether it's the Research Fellows Program, it's the podcast, it's our community of practice, white papers, and all of it's available to you for free. So we highly encourage you to do it. Jennifer, thanks so much for being a part of the podcast today. I do appreciate it, and safe travels.
Thank you for joining us on the Human Capital Lab podcast, a Growth Network podcast production in collaboration with Bellevue University. For more info, visit humancapitallab.org. If you were inspired today, pass the link on to a colleague or friend. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, keep learning to unlock the long-term potential of human capital.